On February 9 of this year, the British government's Treasury Department tweeted out the following. Here's today's surprising hashtag Friday fact. Millions of you have helped end the slave trade through your taxes. Did you know? In 1833, Britain used 20 million pounds, 40% of its national budget, to buy freedom for all slaves in the empire. The amount of money borrowed for the Slavery Abolition Act was so large that it wasn't paid off until 2015, which means that living British citizens helped pay to end the slave trade. Unquote. This financial arrangement was not widely known until this was tweeted and then deleted. It prompted public outrage, not only because generations of British citizens' taxes have gone towards paying this debt, but because the tweet was also factually inaccurate on several counts. Here to discuss this tweet's impact, the history of British slavery and its ramifications globally, is Chris Manjapra, an associate professor of history at Tufts University and author of a recent article for The Guardian's The Long Read titled, When Will Britain Face Up to Its Crimes Against Humanity? I am very pleased to welcome him via phone from Berlin. Welcome.
Thanks so much. It's nice to be here.
So tell us about the tweet that brought this situation to light for the majority of the population and its inaccuracies.
Well, the tweet, which came, as you mentioned, in February, was likely sent out because there have been a number of scholars who have been contacting HM Treasury, that's the Treasury Department of Britain, with Freedom of Information Act requests, and I was one of those. And I had a sense that something was probably going to come out or that the Treasury was probably going to try to spill something. Very interestingly, it came completely by surprise, as I was already working on a piece for The Guardian on this very subject, and almost as a kind of a preemption, I think, although I don't have proof for that, we have the tweet. And the tweet in some ways just, opened up a huge can of worms.
Does the tweet represent a trend in how the British government looks at its history of slavery or this kind of distortion of detail?
You know, I think it is absolutely not an aberration, quite the opposite. It is a symptom of how slavery is discussed in Britain today. You look at the fact that the Treasury Department, or the HM Treasury, I should say, has retracted the tweet, and they've left this crater of silence in its place. So there really is no discussion around it. What can be discussed in Britain, and what some historians even call a kind of national identity for the British, is abolition, the abolition of the slave trade and the abolition of slavery. That gets a lot of attention. But speaking about not just the history of British slavery, the impact of slavery on British finances in the past and today, but also what's come to light, which is absolutely remarkable, which is this long-term, 180-year-long financing of a loan that was used to pay off slave owners at the time of abolition. I mean, that this whole discussion really gets very little place in British public discourse. And I'm so pleased that The Guardian had the courage to print this piece. On the other hand, it's very interesting that beyond the piece coming out, there's been very little official response. There's been no official response to the piece, which goes to this question of the silence around slavery that I think is really endemic to British public discourse of the subject.
And so when was slavery initially abolished in the British Empire?
So that is a good point to clarify. There are two main dates. One is 1807. That's the date in which on which slave trade was abolished in the British Empire. And then we come to the second date, which is 1833. And that's the date on which slavery, meaning plantation slavery, the use of slave labor on plantations in the British Americas and Caribbean, as well as Mauritius and the Cape Colony, when this system was abolished. So there are these two specific dates, and that tweet by HM Treasury, that was, you know, the first big error that was made, which was the confusion of those two dates, and we're really talking about 1833 as the end of slavery.
And what was the stipulation that made it so that despite the 1833 agreement that slavery wasn't actually ended until 1838?
Yeah, very good. This is really a crux of the argument for me. I mean, the argument of why the British government is really historically embroiled in a crime, in an ongoing crime against humanity that continues even after the end of slavery. So 1833 is the date on which the institution of slavery was officially abolished in the British Empire. However, after that date, the British government decided to basically carry the system forward, and it gave it a different name. It was called apprenticeship. Initially in 1833, it was supposed to last for 12 years. That was subsequently shortened to 6 years. And finally, because of protests coming from the apprentices or the slaves, really, you know, on the Caribbean plantations, as well as from activists in Britain, it was finally shortened to 4 years. So we have this official date of its ending in 1833, but the actual ending of the regime came in 1838. And very importantly, the British government administered these last 4 years of what was called apprenticeship, which was really slavery by another name. You know, and I can describe that in a little more detail, but it's the British government basically doing the job of running a slave economy.
Yes. Would you please describe the apprenticeship programs?
Sure. So there was a commission that was set up in Britain, which was a commission to pay slave owners a certain amount of money, a huge amount of money. In addition to this payment that slave owners received, that same commission was given the task of hiring, initially it was 100, and they were called stipendiary magistrates. These were basically policemen or administrators, policemen and administrators hired by the British state in Britain, who were sent after 1833. They started coming in 1834 to the Caribbean as administrators for this new regime, which was called apprenticeship. Now, these stipendiary magistrates who were hired in Britain and sent to the Caribbean, they had the role of, for example, whipping slaves or punishing slaves in various ways, and one of the choice ways was called the treadmill, the use of a treadmill, which was a form of both torture, but also was supposed to inculcate work ethic amongst the apprentices. They were the jailers of the apprentices. They also, it has to be said, they also were involved in making sure that the ex-slave owners, those who were on the plantations, were not whipping the slaves themselves, because now it was the government that was going to be the whipper and the jailer and the imprisoner of these apprentices. There was a lot of problems with the program. Many of these stipendiary magistrates, ended up, either falling away or not being reliable. And so over time, the British government hired more, some of them locally, some of them from Britain, in order to grow the ranks of the stipendiary magistrateship again. And that continued all the way to 1838. So we have a system where the British government in Britain is overseeing this administered system of whipping and jailing and torturing blacks in the Caribbean as well as in Mauritius and in the Cape Colony, and doing it in the name of emancipating them. Right. So this is a kind of, supposedly it's a birth pang of freedom for the slaves, that they had to go through this 4 year period of being quote unquote apprentices. But what that really meant is that they were subjected to ongoing violence and really terrorization, this time administered by the British state.
And where did the money come from to pay the stipendiary magistrates?
So these magistrates were paid by, all the money, the majority of the money that went to supporting the magistrateship, as well as to the huge monetary compensation that went to slave owners, which was the other part of how slavery ended, this all was paid for with money that came from a huge loan. It was a huge loan that the British government took out based in 1835, and it added to that loan with its own securities in subsequent years. It added up to £20 million, which today we're talking now more than 180 years later. Today, that back then, that was 40% of the government receipts of government income. And if we were to calculate it in similar ways today, we'd be talking about £300 billion today. So it was a huge amount of debt that the government took out in order to obtain the money to pay the stipendiary magistrates, but more importantly, in terms of where that money went, it went into the pockets of slave owners.
And where did the money, where was the loan dispensed from?
The loan was dispensed from Britain. It's a, you know, that's an interesting it's an interesting story. It was in 1835, in July 1835, that the government, this is the Treasury Department, HM Treasury, the Exchequer of the Treasury, decided that it was time to organize the funding for the 1833 Abolition Act. In order to do that, they contacted a group of very important bankers in the city of London. Amongst those were the Rothschild Syndicate, so we're talking here of Nathan Meyer Rothschild and Moses Montefiore, who is his brother-in-law. We're also talking of the Barings, and we're talking about a number of other very important bankers in the city of London, who were contacted and asked whether they would be able to put up the money in order for this whole system to be funded. At that point, the government is asking for £15 million. Pounds. Now, it was only one of those banking interests that was able to put up the money or that made a bid, and that was the Rothschild Syndicate. And on August 3rd of 1835 is when the terms of that loan were actually set, and the UK, the British government, received its £15 million over the course of the coming months from the Rothschilds.
I'm speaking with Dr. Chris Monjapra, an associate professor of history at Tufts University, about his new piece for The Guardian's The Long Read, When Will Britain Face Up to Its Crimes Against Humanity? This is Midday on WNYC, and we'll be right back after a break. This is Midday on WNYC, and I'm back with Dr. Chris Monjapra. You write about in the book that Britain's role, central role in 500 years of the slave trade and plantation slavery, is often dissolved like a bitter pill into the much more palatable tonic of the nation's role in the story of abolition. Other than the aforementioned tweet that we started out with, what's another example of how Britain's history of slavery has been suppressed in favor of the abolition narrative?
That's a great question. Well, one concrete example would be that if you were to go today to the National Portrait Gallery in London, you would see hanging a portrait of Wilberforce, who is celebrated as, you know, the great abolitionist, as he's kind of a national figure. In fact, there are 32 portraits of Wilberforce in the collection of the Portrait Gallery, and there are only four portraits of, you know, slaves or of slaves who were activists for their own freedom. So that gives you a sense of how the public or the national discussion goes. There's a lot of focus on how they were called the Clapham Saints, the group that organized around Wilberforce, how they went out and they got freedom for the blacks of the Caribbean. There's very, very little discussion of the ways in which the enslaved themselves were organizing, were going on general strikes, there were many riots and rebellions that were breaking out in the Caribbean over the decades leading up to the 1833, and there's basically a silence around all of that. Furthermore, there's a lot of attention that's given to the role that the British then played in the coming decades after 1833 as the quote-unquote leaders of abolition, but you know, how do we square that with the fact that during those same decades and the decades leading up to even 2 years ago, Britons have been paying for the compensation to slave owners? There's this financial link to a crime against humanity that has been suppressed. You know, and we even see it in the way in what HM Treasury has done just a month ago. They published something on Twitter, they simply retracted it, and there has been no comment ever since.
And so your piece, of course, is called When Will Britain Face Up to Its Crimes Against Humanity? When will Britain face up?
You know, that's a... It's a very, very good question. Part of this is the problem of the broken record, the broken record of defenses and responses to the ongoing work that so many do to bring to attention the ways that British slavery needs to be reckoned with. It can't simply be, as I said in the piece, it can't simply be dissolved as a tonic. You know, in the piece, I talk about a moment in 1997 when the manacled remains of slaves washed up or were found on the Devon shore off the coast of Britain, and that was a moment. Bernie Grant was an MP at the time. He organized a lot around trying to use this moment as an opportunity for discussion on reparations, for a discussion for the demand of an official apology from the British state for slavery. He even said, you know, I'm going to write to the Queen because she's a reasonable woman. And I'm sure that if I write to her and explain the situation, the need for an official apology in order for us to move on, something will happen. Well, Bernie Grant died in 2000. Since that time, he received no apology. You know, those who were slaves back in the time of slavery and their descendants have received no apology up to our very time of speaking now. But since 2000, we see an ongoing and, in fact, an increasing project shared by a number of different folks in Britain, in the Caribbean, in Africa, in order to really bring the question of reparations to the fore. And, you know, reparations is a big topic, but and it means a number of different things, but one of the first things it means is truth. You know, that we have to demand truth, and we have to demand that out, that the British government, which has this continuous and ongoing tie to the compensation of slave owners and to the enslavement of African and African descended peoples, that the British government needs to reckon with this.
I'm struck by the by something that was said by Brian Stevenson, who is an activist and lawyer here in America, who has said that truth and reconciliation is sequential. So we have to have the truth before we can even begin to reconcile. And so, and sort of, you're saying there needs to be an apology before there's any kind of reparation. And I just wonder about that idea of an apology. Like, what does that sound like? What kind of power does that wield? Does that involve a kind of truth, or is it just an act of apology?
Well, you know, I love the terms full and public disclosure of truth. I just think that's a really powerful statement, to demand a full and public disclosure of truth. That, for me, is what official apology means. It's not an I'm sorry. It is a state that has been a part of a history of enslavement, but also of genocide and of crimes against humanity, really taking the step to offer a full and public disclosure. Now, why is that so important? Well, it's important so that those who have been affected by the history of slavery through their families, through their family lines, through their ancestral ties to that time, that they have a sense of an official recognition of what slavery means. But even more than that, it really means that the state is taking the lead in telling the world, its citizens, but also the world, that when something has happened that is really, completely against our beliefs, our what we hold dear, that we really need to kind of make it right. And the making of right, I think, happens after the offering of the apology. And, you know, if you were to look on, for example, the website of the Caribbean Reparations Committee, there's a long discussion of what making it right means. I think there's been a very extensive discussion amongst African American intellectuals and British African British intellectuals and Caribbean intellectuals about what it means to make something right after having offered that anthropology, it really involves addressing the structural issues of racism, of institutionalized racism, of political and economic expressions of racism, of international expressions of racism. When you look at, for example, the level of debt that Caribbean countries suffer under, you know, that there one obvious discussion to have is how that international debt might be forgiven. That's one of the things that the reparation committees of the Caribbean are asking. If we were to read, you know, a great thinker on this topic, Ta-Nehisi Coates, he has that famous article on A Case for Reparations. You know, one of the things that he's talking about, which I think also holds true in the British case, is addressing the economic insecurity that blacks in America face, and we can see the same thing in Britain. Blacks in Britain are far more likely to work temporary jobs, to suffer from insecurity. They're far more likely to be ending up in prison, and they are also far less likely to be represented in government, to be represented amongst academics, to be represented in the law courts. You know, these are structural matters that really need attention, and my sense is that, you know, that in some ways the alibi of abolition and Britain as a kind of abolition state, this is an alibi in order to really keep the status quo, when in fact there's a crying need to address the ways that institutionalized racism are alive and well in British society today, as well as in the British Empire, you know, and the aftermath of the British Empire, especially as we see it expressed in the Caribbean.
I've been speaking with Dr. Chris Monjapra about his new piece for The Guardian's The Long Read, titled When Will Britain Face Up to Its Crimes Against Humanity? Thank you so much for joining me today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.